visioningabetteramerica@gmail.com. And I am delighted to welcome Clark Strickland, who is going to present Revisioning Slavery's University in the New South. She is a student, a scholar, and an activist. And I'm particularly happy to have her participate because many of the earlier presenters, being older, were talking about how to reach younger people. And so I'm happy to actually have a student come and speak to us. So let me say that Clark Strickland is an American Studies major with a minor in African American Studies at the University of the South, also called SWANE. Originally from Chattanooga, Tennessee, Clark is passionate about fostering inclusive spaces that empower marginalized communities, especially in the Deep South. She is the vice president and charter member for the Youth and College Division Unit of the NAACP at the University of the South. Through the NAACP, she addresses inequities facing African American communities and other marginalized groups on campus. She is the research school's She is the research assistant for the Robertson Project on Slavery, Race, and Reconciliation, which addresses the school's history as the only U.S. college created to preserve slavery and the insurgent Confederate society and economy. Early presidents of the school were Confederate generals who fought against the United States. Recently, Clark was named a 2021 Truman Scholar. Welcome.
Thank you, and thank you for that kind introduction. Hello, everyone. My name is Clark Strickland, and I am a senior at the University of the South, an American Studies major. And as Dr. Mongoli said, I am also a student researcher for the Robertson Project on Slavery, Race, and Reconciliation. So today, you know, my presentation is on re-envisioning Slavery's University, and it's a term coined by the director of our project. So what I want to focus on in the beginning is the challenge that's created within re-envisioning, you know, Slavery's University. And so the University of the South was an institution dedicated to educating the sons of Southern planters and preserving the plantation society, including the clause of reinforcing a system of racial hierarchy. And for so long, our community had sought to discard this history until recently, in the fall of 2020, when our Board of Regents recognized our historical ties to the Confederacy and Lost Cause mythologies. And in that instance, our university sought to transform our history and our narrative by actually acknowledging it and continuing on a path towards transforming that history. And so from this question and from, you know, the actions of our university, one thing that has kind of remained the same is, you know, where do we go from here? And so before I kind of start going into my ideas and the work that I've done in relation to this topic, I wanted to tell you guys a few facts about the university. And so the first fact is that the university's organizing efforts began in the late 1850s, and especially kind of tie in with the laying of the cornerstone in 1860. And so the university's organizing efforts were led by bishops and Episcopal Church, because we are an Episcopal institution. And so one of the Episcopal bishops, Bishop Leonidas Polk of Louisiana, said of the purpose of a Southern institution to another bishop, Elliot, who is also a founder of our university. And he said the institution was indispensable for our protection, our security, and our prosperity. And in the R, he really emphasizes the need of white men and their Southern sons who would come to that university to be educated on that topic. Because to understand Bishop Polk's sentiments, you have to understand that he had been a planter, a Southern planter that profited from the exploitation of Black bodies in the South. And it utilized the status to assume more societal prestige and economic uplift. The increasing Northern sentiment of abolition and separation and a war, you know, found its way into the lives of our founders who feared that the North would take away their Southern aristocracy in the way that they made their living. And so in many instances, Polk's words to Eliot are a way to protect their way of life and their ways of life. And I think that was what the university was also meant to do. And so by the time we get to 1860, with the laying of the cornerstone, it's a pivotal moment in our history. And it's a pivotal moment because it defines who we are, who's at the table in those instances, and who's speaking at this event is really a representation of what the university was meant to be. And so I go to the figure who was our main speaker at the time, who is John Preston. He's a former Southern planter turned businessman who's just sold his hummus plantation for a market value of $1 million at that time, which was a lot of money. And so in that instance, he reiterates in his speech the need for a Southern university to protect Southern interests. And those interests, for many of them who were enslavers and who profited off of the slave economy, was the exploitation of Black bodies, but also a religious belief and that grounding and the intertwined relationship between the two. And so actors like John Preston are important, you know, to our history. And when we look at the history of the university, because it demonstrates directly the ties that our university had since its founding and the laying of the cornerstone to the slave aristocracy and what the university would be, especially as an educational institution that would teach these values to its students who would have been white males at the time because it was a male institution. So when we're looking at John Preston, you know, who is better to give this main speech of what the university would be than John Preston, who just sold his plantation for over $1 million, ended up being a colonel in the Confederacy, and holds all of these ideals. And so I think we can learn more about our university's history through looking at the actors who it allowed to speak for them. And so the second point that I really want to emphasize is that the Civil War set back initial plans for the opening of the university, and the doors would eventually open in 1868. So many scholars within the university and outside have contended that after the Civil War, the university discontinued its ideas grounded in racial inferiority and subscribe to those of the Union. So basically what that means is that the previous ideals of Polk, who sought to preserve this slaveholding aristocracy and preserve the ways of the Old South, you know, was ended at the battlefield. After the Confederacy lost, scholars contend that the university became that of the United States and represented something that would come together to form these values of a union. And that is simply not true. From, you know, looking at the founding professors who would end up teaching, especially in the college calendar year of 1870, and different ones, a lot of them had ties to the Confederacy, had held roles in the Confederacy, or had been former planters themselves. And so after the Civil War, from what I've researched and the readings that I've read from the work of our founders, is that the university becomes a haven for instrumental actors in the Confederacy. They found employment and an environment in which they could intertwine their work into the curriculum of the college, which is a very important point because we are an educational institution, which also goes to show that this was also another second grounding in the act of using education to preserve a system of racial inferiority. And one of the main actors, you know, that I sought to present today was Josiah Gorgas, who is a namesake for Gorgas Dormitory on our campus, but he's also mentioned in Douglas Blackman's Slavery by Another Name. And so Blackman characterizes him, you know, as a general in the Confederacy and the architect of a slave-driven Alabama wartime industrial complex. You know, and this differs from the description that we get from some sources from our university's history, where they characterize him as a former headmaster. And then in the calendar year of 1870, he's a professor of engineering and physics. And in that regard, the importance of Gorgas to the university is a demonstration of how the university continued to foster ideals, the ideals of the original founders, who believed that the institution would be one that educated the next generation of Southern planters. Now, after the Civil War, we know slavery is non-existent. So new systems of Black exploitation, you know, needed to be created and exist to maintain the racial order of the South. And this is kind of what Slavery by Another Name really dissects in and really seeks to emphasize. And I think it's something that we can learn from Gorgas, who took enslaved Black people off the plantation and put them into an industrial setting, you know, and this is the precursor to Slavery by Another Name on shifting ways in which Black bodies are exploited. And so thinking of Gorgas now as a professor, you know, even though we don't have the documents that he would have taught, we can only imagine, you know, teaching engineering and physics and having been the architect of this exploitation of Black bodies that's moved from the plantation setting, you know, what types of teaching he would have been teaching his students, you know, about further ideas of Black exploitation within the classrooms and really grounding them in this idea of a racial caste system. And so these few examples really set the stage for the university after the Civil War and well into the 20th century, and how the university, you know, after the Confederacy, continues to perpetuate lost cause pathologies within its educational curriculums and social environments. Because after the Civil War, you know, you have big groups, including, you know, the Daughters of the Confederacy, you know, who spark up, and there are groups at the university that do those same things to protect lost cause mythologies and erect monuments and memorials the regard to the Confederacy. And so it just shows how there is a continuation of the original founders' ideals within the involvement of the university. So now we're going back to the question at hand. So where do we go from here? We know all of this information, you know, we've gathered it, we're still learning more. How do we enact in this transformation that's going to create safe learning environments for students at the university? Because students at the university don't look the same way they did in 1870. There's women, there's men, there are all different types of genders and races that attend the university. At this aspect. So where do we go from here? Is kind of the question, from this exclusive place to an inclusive space. And so I've kind of outlined two key themes that I think work to engage in this transformation. I don't think there is a clear-cut solution, but I think there is progress to be made from that. I don't think any system of oppression has one simple fix. I think it's a multitude of different strategies and programs that seek to uplift marginalized communities. And so the two main themes that I outline is the archive, you know, which is a learning instrument for learning history, but also monuments and memorials. And so I'll start with the archives. So the university archives at our university really tells the story of white Sewanee. But what does it say about Black students on campus or the historic Black community of St. Mark's? And it doesn't really say that much. And so for my work, I've really been able to engage in these questions and really work to create the resources and gather those resources to help it become a more inclusive space. And so the first kind of point I would like to make is that through my work with the Roberson Project and different campus initiatives, I was able to create a Black timeline, which was a timeline of the first generations of Black alumni to attend the university. And so the first Black student to graduate from the university, specifically the college, was in 1970, and his name is Nathaniel Owens. And so I started with conversations of looking for Mr. Owens after our university had a 50 years of women's celebration. And I had figured that his 50 years was coming up. And so I reached out to alums on campus, and no one had his contact information. So this meant that I needed to go researching to find it. And when I finally did, we had conversations, and I really just engaged his interest in wanting to tell his story, because it was another side of the university's narrative that hadn't been told before. And I thought it was really important, you know, to have these stories of Black students who went to the campus in times of stress and, you know, this beginning towards creating a better future of desegregation and integration. And so from Mr. Owens's oral history that I did, I created an article. And from that, you know, I kept asking questions about what was more to learn. And so this started a journey toward creating a comprehensive timeline to mark the 55-year celebration of Black alumni at the university, with Father Green graduating 55 years ago as the first Black student at the Theological Seminary. And so I created this outline to really tell those stories and intertwine their narratives with the larger one of the university. And so that meant their achievements, their social programming and clubs, you know, so the creation of Black student unions, what was the campus climate at the time, what were their experiences? And I'm still learning from that and still gathering more resources to be able to tell a more holistic story of the university in that aspect. And so the second marker that I'll highlight on is my summer work in the year of 2019, where I worked with the Roberson Project on digitalizing oral histories. And so what that meant was we had digitalization days where we gathered materials from members of the historic St. Mark's community. And we took oral history interviews and we did community mapping. And we just created a relationship with that community to be able to give them a platform to tell their stories. Because often in the archives, you'll have other members of the Sewanee community who are more often than not white, that will tell the perspective of the St. Mark's community. And so we really wanted them to have their own space to be able to tell those stories and share their experiences and the experiences of their ancestors who had lived on the mountain for generations. And so that work was really meaningful to me because we were able to later create a website for them so that they could see those different artifacts and that it would be with them and their family members forever, and their descendants could continuously look and add to that website as well. So it's more of an online archive. And so the second point that I would like to highlight was the idea of hostile learning environments. And so that's kind of what is created when you have a university that was founded on the fact of Black exploitation and white supremacy. And so in that aspect, our entire campus is a Confederate monument in a sense. The memorials, the plaques, the street names are all either named after owning dioceses who were slave owners, well, not owning dioceses, but individuals who were slave owners or attributed or subscribe to lost cause narratives and segregation and different things like that. So the question becomes, what do you do when your entire campus is a Confederate monument? And so many have talked about name changes or different programs. And I think that when you have this problem of your campus being an entire Confederate monument, you have to think about, if we change the name, how will we still educate our students in our community and anyone that comes inside the domain on what the history of the university was and what it is now. And I think that needs to be grounded in empowering the Black voices whose exploitation created the endowment for the university and funded the buildings that were able to be built and named after these enslavers or subscribers to Lost Cause narratives and different things like that. And so I've worked on projects within my university to really outline that and look at how building spaces can be artistically done to where it empowers Black voices and it tells a story. And I think that's the most important part, because I think when we tell stories, it enables people to listen more, and it's a new side to the story. And so in that aspect, we weren't always telling the full story. And so given the artistic expression in buildings, whether it's memorials, whether it's murals or a tour, or different programming that happens within that building to tell more about its history, it's telling a side that we've never done before. And it's, you know, a bold action when you haven't done it for over 100 years since your university was created. And so it makes a statement to those, you know, who are in the same, who are similar to you in these aspects and are working to create more inclusive spaces as well. And so one of the things I thought about within that aspect was, how do we create living modes of history that tell a story as you walk to class or eat, and have and create an everyday reminder in that aspect? And I think that when you have art, when you have tours, when you have paintings and different things that tell a new narrative of the university or a new narrative of different ideals, then I think you can have those living modes of history. And I think you can always expand upon them as the time changes, because like I said before, I don't think there's any quick fix or solution that will end oppression. I think it's a generational effort in progress and commitment that you do have to make. And so, you know, the last kind of point is, how can students get involved in this work, and how especially can citizens get involved? And I think in the area that I'm working with, when we're determining the relationship between educational institutions and more extensive conversations on rectifying the misdeeds of our past, so conversations on reparations and different things like that, we have to decide what the role educational institutions with slavery will have in this conversation, and what role the federal government will have. And I think in that aspect, in the conversations that I've had with different individuals, it's important to know, to think about what educational institutions are intended to do. And they're intended to educate the next generations of students, faculty, and staff in every regard, and give them the tools they need to be citizens in our society. And so when I think of that, I think of the idea of educational institutions and reparations and being a motivator of, like I said, utilizing living modes of history to tell a story on their campus, but also as institutions holding their federal government accountable for doing the same thing. And so while Sewanee isn't like other campuses still do have Confederate monuments or buildings named after Klan members or subscribers to Lost Cause mythologies and different things like that. So I think there should be an institutional initiative to hold those around them accountable to doing this transformative work, while also holding the United States government to doing that as well and engaging in conversations of reparations and what that will look like. Because I think reparations is more than just providing a check. It's investing in Black communities and being intentional about the investments and programs that you're doing. And it's a generational thing. So it just can't happen within a span of 1 to 5 years. It has to be continuously progressed and continuously supported in an effort to dig at racial oppression and different things like that. And so one of the final things that I'll say today is that in many regards to my research, I found that the University of the South is a microcosm of the United States. And so the initiatives and things that we're doing on campus can really be used to guide the United States and other and its entities in doing this transformative work. And I think that is also the case for a lot of schools who hold ties to the slave trade and slavery. And so I think if these schools were to get together as they are in the consortium of universities studying slavery and hold the federal government accountable to doing the same thing, then I think we can begin to engage in that transformative work. And so one of kind of the concrete things that I thought about how citizens and other people can really get involved in this work is that as we're actively finding out more history and doing more work, I think that one of the things that we found, you know, most helpful is for the public to do public transcriptions. And that just happens on websites that have older documents where people on the internet can do transcriptions of them. And it's easier for researchers to then go back and look at them because the transcriptions are already there, because someone's already read the handwriting and different things like that. And so, you know, that's a great way to get involved, but also encouraging your institution to engage in these actions. When you're alumni or you're on different boards or you're on city government, engaging those local officials to hold their federal government accountable to engaging in this work is really important. And so, I would say have conversations with your local policymakers, have them have conversations with those ahead of them to really engage in this. So thank you.